views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to the Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Today's show, we are going to be talking about cyber espionage and cyber warfare. And unfortunately for all of us, it's becoming a way of life for our governments, business, and it really impacts us every day. Our lives are really becoming integrated into various data-driven technologies and everything that we do, whether we're banking online, we're booking airline tickets for vacation, or I'm communicating with my college kids across the country, whether texting them or even talking on my cell phones. It's likely with all this information that we're spreading out our data all over the place, traveling all over the country. It's out there, and almost every aspect of our life can now be hacked and controlled by anyone. You don't know if it's the person down the street, the bad guy, or the bad guy in another country that is getting into our data, or if it's NSA getting into our data and messing around with our privacy. We really have some big problems that we need to deal with, and all this data that we need to protect, we need to figure this out if we want to maintain a free, stable, and safe society where commerce can be unhampered and our privacy can be maintained. Well, this episode, we're going to dive into all these issues. We have Bob Weiss joining us. He's kind of our resident expert on this area of business. It's a very serious topic, but he's does it in a fairly humorous manner. And we're going to be talking about the hacker group Anonymous and how they have just recently declared war on ISIS. We're also going to be talking about Snowden and NSA. And Bob wants to talk about password protection. He has really focused a lot on how to just protect yourself in general. And there's been some interesting developments in password protection. We're also going to talk about the dark web. And, of course, we get back into cyber warfare with various countries, including China, Russia, Iran, and ISIS. So that is what we're going to be doing right now. So let's welcome Bob Weiss to the program. Hey, Bob, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me back on. I'm looking forward to it. We've certainly got some exciting stuff going on.
Well, there's always exciting stuff. That's why I like to have you back every so often, because you have to give us your humorous insight into all this cyber war stuff. Well, let's start with Anonymous. Anonymous just declared war on ISIS. First, can you tell people who Anonymous is?
Yeah, Anonymous is a hacker collective, and I will use the term hacker. I'm very reluctant to use the term hacker when talking about cyber criminals. And they're not hackers. They're criminals who use electronics, you know. A hacker is somebody who, you know, basically likes to take stuff apart, figure out how it works, extend it, play with it, break it, try to do stuff that wasn't designed for it. But the Anonymous Collective started back in 2002 as they had the board B on 4chan, which is, you can check out at 4chan.org. And it was a non-organized collective of computer enthusiasts who would meet on this board and chat and come up with like little self-assigned tasks that they'd give to themselves, and then they go off and do this stuff. And
they try to do good, right? But they're afraid.
Well, for the most part, I mean, what I want to call Anonymous is, you know, they're kind of like all about civil disobedience. Okay, so they fall into a long line of civil, you know, disobedience groups like, say, the Founding Fathers, or, you know, Henry David Thoreau, or Mahatma Gandhi, or whatever. People who are doing things that are illegal, they're breaking the law in order to create an outcome that's political or social justice or has something to do with freedom or liberty or things like that.
Well, and they wear those masks. Those
the John Fox masks.
Yeah.
And which just adds to the whole coolness, but
or scariness if you're afraid of clowns.
If you've ever seen the movie V for Vendetta that's used, you know, in that movie, and I don't know that that's where they got it, but I'm thinking that V for Vendetta may have gotten that mask from them. But in any event, what's happened in the wake of the Friday the 13th attacks in Paris, you know, on Saturday, a French member of Anonymous released, you know, what basically looked like a news release on YouTube where they basically declared war on, declared war on ISIS. And they're going after, of course, websites, recruiter sites, communication channels. They're trying to hack their Twitter feeds and, you know, Facebook stuff and other types of communication channels like, you know, IRC or Internet Relay Chat channels that they use for furthering their agenda.
And they're really
and for
active.
For organizing their military activities against the West.
Is ISIS really active in the black web? Is that where you find
them? Yeah, just about everybody who is doing stuff like that is working in the dark web and through Tor. And I've written about Tor a few times. And Tor is an anonymizing service that uses a chain of proxies to kind of hide your location and what have you. But, you know, hey, the guys in Anonymous, they use Tor too. So they know how it works and they're, you know, they're busy after them. Now I took a look there's a really cool attack, you know, cyber attack website run by a company called Norse, N-O-R-S-E at Norse.com. And so I was watching yesterday and there are just a tremendous amount of attacks going toward Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, and Dubai.
And is that where they think it's all coming out of then?
Well, that's where the money is.
Okay.
And, you know, so they're attacking financial accounts or trying to get in and either get at the money or make it impossible for ISIS to get at the money by creating these huge denial of service attacks against these, you know, banking websites in the Arabian Peninsula. But there's interesting clusters of activity coming out of Amsterdam, and there's really a weird bunch of activity going toward the French city in Provence of Aix-en-Provence, which I have no idea what that's all about. But
so you don't know if the activity is the good guys or the bad guys. You just see a lot of activity.
Yeah, you just see, you know, basically there's a scroll. It's really kind of hard to read, but you can see, you know, the source and destination and what internet protocol is being used in the attack, whether it's, you know, secure shell or FTP or something else.
And do you think they're able to hurt ISIS with this
I think they
war
could,
they've
you know,
committed?
Yeah, I think they could be a formidable addition to what I'm sure, you know, U.S. Cyber Command and the GCHQ out of, you know, England and the French, whatever their cyber war group is called. I mean, France, you know, France took the gloves off right away and just went at it. And the Russians are right behind them because, of course, the downing of that airliner in Egypt turns out to have been caused by a bomb.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff coming together, and, you know, I hate to be rattling the saber, but it makes me wonder, you know, like, what's up with us?
Well, yeah. Who are we funding?
Are we going to wait until something happens here and then go attack them? I mean, you know.
But the question, too, is who are we funding? Are we funding some of Anonymous, or are we funding – you hear reports that we're actually arming ISIS. I mean, what's going on with us?
Well, you know, the thing is that when this whole Arab Spring thing came out, and taking a look at sort of the geopolitics of the region, you know, we got all excited with the Arab Spring. And actually Anonymous was helping support that movement too. So they go back, you know, that they've done that. That ISIS went after, Anonymous went after ISIS after Charlie Hebdo last year. And, or earlier this year, I guess. And,
well, they must be tied into the CIA and getting support.
I don't know about that. The people who are in Anonymous typically are anti-governmental types.
Okay.
And, for instance, one of the things that ISIS has done that's notable is hacked a U.S. Senate website and put some stuff out there. But
ISIS did this?
Or not ISIS. I mean
Anonymous.
Anonymous has done this.
So they're not creating very many friends in the government.
No, no. But ISIS, you know, ISIS gets a lot of their weapons from stuff that got left behind when the Iraqi army retreats. And, of course, we provided that stuff. At the time of the Arab Spring, you know, ISIS was really forming. And we were supporting the freedom fighters without asking a whole lot of questions. And so, yeah, I'm sure that there's arms and stuff that we supplied to the bad guys one way or another. But here again, you know, on the dark web, you want to buy guns, they got guns. I mean, the dark web is a really cool,
it's cool. You can buy guns.
Full underground marketplace for buying stuff that you can't get at Walmart. I mean, you know,
it's really cool. You can buy any kind of top machine gun. Can you get a tank from the dark web?
You know, it's probably possible. You know, there's a lot of old arms floating around the world, and, you know, a lot of times, you know, when we pull out of a place, we don't take all our gear back, you know. In a lot of cases, we leave it behind for, you know, whoever we're nominally supporting, and so, you know, the stuff gets around.
Exactly. You know, the scary part for me is the recent article which I saw about the Russian nuclear torpedo, and that scares the heck out of me, and the reason why is because it's so powerful, right? It basically will wipe out everything in the area. It can create a 1,000-foot tsunami. It will wipe out everything. Like if it hits New York, it'll kill everybody, even people hiding in bunkers. And it'll make it so that commerce cannot happen there for a long time. I mean, it's a weapon that gets it done. The scary part is, now, will those be accessible in cyberspace, and how much control will they really, you know, how many really powerful weapons are vulnerable, you know?
Yeah.
That's the scary part.
Well, and that is a real open question. You know, once this stuff starts to exist, there's always somebody who, you know, needs the money, or who is just a little bent or twisted or whatever, and is, you know, happy to take it in a different direction. You know, in some cases, like, you know, when we were developing atomic weapons at the end of World War II, there were people, you know, in this country who felt it was important to provide that information to the Russians so that there would be a balance, so that there wouldn't be an overwhelming power in the hands of just one country kind of a thing. And, you know, in some cases they did it, shall we say, did the wrong thing for the right reasons, or what, I don't know how we want to phrase it, but, you know, and then it turned out
they weren't very smart in their strategy.
You know, it goes from one to two, and then before you know it, it's three, you know, because the French were hard at it, and then all of a sudden it's everywhere, and, you know, the Pakistanis have it, and the Indians have it, and the Chinese have it, and God knows who the heck else. The Iranians evidently are working on it, if they don't already have it, and, you know, so
it's scary because you look at the dark web, if they're selling things as big, you know, the automatic weapons and tanks, if you know that they have military gear, then behind the scenes, that's when you meet them. And then once you start talking to them directly, that's when you get to see what they really have, I'm sure. They're not going to, because it's, they're still protecting themselves as far as,
And, you know, the thing with Russia right now is that, with the, you know, with the fall of communism, the capitalist path that Russian business has taken really, really corresponds nicely to sort of like, Depression era Chicago. There were certainly lots of legitimate businesses running, but there was a lot of stuff that was going on that was just basically very highly organized criminal activity. And we have that in Russia. A lot of Russian cybercrime groups are run by ex-KGB, and in many cases, these companies, and they're, you know, I mean, they're incorporated, they're regular go-in-the-business type companies. They'll have members on their board of directors from the government. And, you know, so they're
integrated
protected
into their government.
So it's, you know, they're protected, and sometimes stuff happens that may not be necessarily what Putin would have preferred, but because, you know, these guys are protected or what have you, things happen, and then it's kind of like, oops, you know, too bad about that.
Well, that happens in our country a lot, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure, you know, same story. The thing with weapons, of course, is that they're just such a, you know, there's so many of them there floating around. And okay, so they're supposedly under, you know, lock and key and control systems, but, you know.
It's one of those, it's where we know enough to be dangerous, but not, we don't know enough to protect ourselves. That's what it feels like. The human race is becoming capable of doing things, but not capable enough to protect ourselves from our own idiocy.
Yeah, we're not doing a really good job of thinking through consequences, or if we're thinking them through, which I'm sure we are, we're just going, well, too bad, and we got to do this anyway, kind of thing.
The consequences, the risks are worth the rewards, kind of thing.
Well, you know, take a look at ISIS. So they pull off this, you know, this exercise in, this act of warfare. I refuse to call it terrorism anymore. It's just another hate speech word, as far as I'm concerned. This is warfare. And
it really is, because there's 200.
May not be a traditional standing army, but they're an army.
Well, if you think about it, because if there's 240,000 Syrians that have been killed, then we're in war, right? Yeah, and they're absolutely in war against us, yeah.
Well, and this is just, you know, this is an act of warfare. It's, you know, not the first time civilian casualties have occurred in time of war.
Yeah, but that's awful when people are cowering, you know, they're cowering in a theater and they're shooting at them anyways. There's war that, although we killed a lot of civilians in World War II, I've been watching a lot of history.
The bombing of Dresden, which was totally unnecessary from a military standpoint, but it was kind of like the last city in Germany we hadn't bombed, so we just went and bombed it anyway.
Yeah, so we were killing a lot of innocent civilians, and not just Japan, where it's obvious that we did. We were doing it as a practice of war. There got to a point where we were doing it as a practice to destroy the morale of the army.
Yeah,
so
exactly. And, you know, and unfortunately, you know, non-combatants get in the way. Now, in this particular case, of course, these people were targeted, not specifically, you know, for who they were, but they were targeted because of where they were.
Yeah, it's awful.
And the incident at the stadium evidently was supposed to have been much worse and wasn't.
Oh.
The restaurant shootings, those are just, you know, freaky scary, but, you know, every time, you know, I mean, this is me, okay, you know, Mr. Paranoid. You know, when I go out to a public place, sit down in a restaurant to eat, my back is facing a corner and I'm watching the door. That's just me.
The older you get, the more you see, the more paranoid you get, or more conservative you are.
Who's coming in the door? What's going on? And I always have a plan. I always have an exit strategy. I always have a combat strategy if it comes to that. I think about these things every time I go out to eat.
Wow.
And I'm not even ex-military. I'm just, like, probably, you know, psychologically paranoid person. person, which makes me great at what I do.
It but, probably does. That probably
well,
does.
Well, sure,
because
I think about what, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen here and what's the, you know, what do you have to do to A, survive it or end it or, you know.
That's really great because it's either, you either have to be like that or you have to be a criminal where you really understand how the criminals think. That's a good point.
Well, and it's kind of like, you know, you have to think about these things. And now I'm sure people who are going out to dine in Paris, you know, there's a whole lot more, you know, hypervigilance going on and as it should be.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky that we've avoided it so far. But there's with that many people dying in the Middle East, you know, 250,000, and I don't know how many years it's been, it's going to hit us at some point. We're not talking what's happened in Iraq and all these other places, all the people that have been killed. It's going to affect us at some point.
Yeah. The mistake that we made, you know, here in the United States with the Arab Spring thing was we supported the wrong people. And I hate to say this, but we supported the freedom fighters. As much as I would have loved for that to have worked out, you know, what happened in Egypt? So they threw out the government and then they elected the Islamic Brotherhood to power.
Yeah,
well,
the bad.
The Islamic Brotherhood are the whole antithesis of giving me civil rights.
Oh, exactly. And the problem is that creates hatred in the country. Even if they can't see that we meant well and we were trying to help them, they see what our actions produced and they don't believe us. No. And so then they hate us. And so that's what we're seeing.
This is what's different between, you know, Russia's response in Syria and our response. Russia's supporting the Assad regime. And, you know, Bashar Assad as far as the U.S. is concerned, we're trying to get him to step down and replace him with a democratic government. But you can't, democratic governments don't work in that part of the world because it's not part of the value system of the people living there.
Well, I don't understand why we're so bent on doing that. If they had a peaceful environment and a peaceful state, I don't understand why we're so bent on getting rid of Assad.
Hate to say it, but Iraq worked better under Saddam Hussein than it does today.
Well, I know. And Assad had one of the most peaceful countries there. People said it was very peaceful. There wasn't violence. They worked well with their neighbors.
Yep. They could do stuff. They could, you know, live their lives. There wasn't a whole lot of repression.
Well,
in the way of free speech or press, but, you know, for the most part, they had day-to-day lives that worked.
People were relatively happy, but the thing is that I read something of, you know, they gassed 500 or so of their own people, and he's using weapons on his own people. So we're going to go and start a war and kill 250,000 people? You know, that's the result of it? It doesn't make sense.
Oh, no.
There's something else here.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate situation that, quite frankly, goes back to the end of World War One. And, if you know anything about, Thomas Lawrence, you know, Lawrence of Arabia and the Arab army that he put together to fight the Turks.
Yeah.
And for, you know, British.
Yeah. Explain that a little bit because
Well, at the end of World War One, you know, Thomas, you know, T.E. Lawrence, you know, better known as Lawrence of Arabia, had pretty much promised the Saudis and other Bedouin tribes that he had organized there that they would have independence and self-rule at the end of the war. That was going to be their gift for helping the British. And, of course, the British and the French instead did the colonial thing and divided the whole place up into zones that they controlled. And they drew the boundaries with no regard to things like Sunni and Shiite and what group of people.
It was all for their benefit and not for the benefit of the local people.
And they threw people together who didn't like each other and to begin with, and who were religiously opposed to each other. We dug this hole and unfortunately, I think we're still digging. If anything, a little faster than we have in the past. But right now, it's such a mess that we're basically being dragged along by events. And it's not that we're controlling anything. It's that we're desperately reacting.
Well, and I think the problem is a lot of people don't understand the history of all of what happened. And we're not being fed. Our media is not sharing what really is going on and really what the history is. And so we're just being fed there's a terrorist attack, and it's awful, and it is awful. But people, if you understood the greater context of what was going on, it's probably scarier if you understood the greater context of what was going on.
So anyway, you know, the peace in the Middle East, probably not anything I'm going to have a hope in heck of adding to. I did take a look at, you know, it's kind of like, this happened to me on September 11th, too. It's like I wanted to go to a recruiter and sign up, but I was, you know, I knew I was too old, so I didn't. Instead, I went to the Red Cross and gave blood. As it turned out, blood that wasn't needed because everybody was dead. But,
that was a sad situation.
But so, you know, ISIS declares war. Bob goes on to the ISIS website and says, you know, how do I join? And it's really funny because I put the link in my blog, both the standard, you know, HTML link and then the Tor link. And the basic thing on the anonymous website is, you're not worthy. Please go away.
So that's what you did.
So
you
try and talk you out of it.
To join, you tried to join anonymous, not ISIS.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I'm sorry.
Let's just clarify that, everyone.
I have not wanted to try. Yeah. Hello, NSA. That's not what I meant. I know you're listening. That's not what I meant. I tried to join anonymous, although I don't know that that's a more, you know, the safer thing to confess, but too late. It's already on my blog, so hit the web. It's free.
Well, but if they're going to do something, they're going to take care of it, and it provides us protection. I mean, we're kind of in a bad situation. We have to take care of ourselves.
Well, they Anonymous should at least put up like a crowdfunding thing where you can throw money in a pot.
We'd be funding it.
I think there's a lot of people that'd be willing to help. You know,
I think you're right, actually.
Yeah.
Well, so, let's get into a more directly, something that impacts all of us directly. You've been covering password issues.
Yeah. And there's been a whole little flock of password stuff in the last, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. And so I kind of put together a little series on my website. And the first one, which is just cuter in a bug's ear, is the girl Mira Modi, who is selling really hard to crack passwords for $2. And she's 11 years old. She's got a website, and you can buy a password from her. This will contain a password that you can remember that has 4 words in it. So it'll be words, but it's going to be a phrase. Okay. And she develops these words by rolling dice and referring to a list that was created by another guy named Arnold Reinhold.
Well, what's an example? Like, what would she create that would be?
Well, let's see here if I got it in my, no, I don't, but it'd be something like, you know, horse, tuba, antithesis, you know, Zen or something like that. And so you'd have just regular words. The point is that because it's, yeah, correct horse, battery, staple. The point is that the longer the password, the longer it takes to decrypt using software. And the thing is that most passwords, whatever you've chosen, are stored on a website in decrypted form. The game for guys who harvest passwords is to get into the web server, download the usernames and passwords, and then they turn software loose to compare, you know, solutions against, you know, solutions that they've created using every possible combination.
If they get like 200,000 passwords and they run the software program again, within 6 months, they probably have cracked all of them.
Yep, exactly. And so the point is that when you get out to like 12 or 13 or 14 characters, the amount of time that it would take, it winds into the centuries. And so at the end of this, like, 6 month, I'm cracking your password exercise, these guys are going to end up with, you know, 3 or 4 or 5% of passwords that were just too long to be solved. And those passwords will remain, you know,
they can't sell them.
Unscathed. And then the other people who've been solved for, all that stuff goes up for sale. And that kind of like the recent one with Comcast. Now, the Comcast passwords that were released didn't come from Comcast servers, but because, you know, user IDs are typically email addresses. So it's like, you know, bob@comcast.net. So they collected all the comcast.net stuff and said, here, we've got passwords for Comcast users. And although it didn't come from Comcast, people are pretty bad about using the same password over and over again. So this gets you into somebody's email account. And when you can sit and read other people's emails over a period of months or, you know, weeks or months, you can get to know them at a very, very deep level. And when you're ready to strike, you know where they bank, you know where they shop, you know where they, you know, who they know, they, you know everything about them.
Yeah.
And then you just basically go in and clean out their, you know, clean them out. And so.
That's awful.
Yeah, yeah. So losing control of your email account can actually be worse than losing control of your credit card number. Because a credit card number, you know, any losses there are covered by the credit card company, so you're not, and they'll give you a new card with a different number, and it's over. Losing control of your email account for a period of time can mean that your whole life has been revealed to some people who may not be that nice. So, you know.
That's not a good thing. So how common?
It's like this kid, this, you know, what, 13-year-old boy who hacked the AOL account of the director of Central Intelligence.
I mean, that's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened to the boy?
I don't know. He's probably working there now. But, I mean, seriously, you know.
Well, I know. They were like, wow, you're pretty bright. Let's cool get kid, him. You know? Yeah, let's get him focused in a positive way.
I got work for you right here. Yeah.
So how common on the dark web is password selling?
It's a big business. And the web is awash in password information. It's kind of like credit card stuff. There's so much of it that it's just cheaper than dirt. And this, you know, what was it, 2,500 Comcast emails that went for $1,000 or something like that?
Oh, wow.
I mean, you know, the prices are dirt cheap. And so – you know, the guys that do this work are selling in bulk and, you know, kind of like making it up on volume to use an corny old retail phrase.
Well, it's a serious business, very organized, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's coming out of like India and Russia and things?
India, Russia, China, the other parts of Southeast Asia. Russia's really big on you know, all forms of cybercrime. You see stuff coming out of Ukraine and, you know, some of the Eastern Bloc, you know, former Eastern Bloc. Brazil, due to their lack of extradition, is a very popular, you know, location for cyber criminals.
Well,
you know, so it's kind of...
It's all over the world.
And then, you know, we've got our friends in Nigeria. Nigeria has been a problem for ages, but they tend to focus on the sad story email where I'm going by transferring all this money and you get a piece. But
so, well, Yahoo has an email service that requires no password.
Yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
And, yeah, how is that possible?
Well, here's the thing about passwords that, you know, in order to make passwords work, you have to go long. We already talked about that today. And the problem is that as the equipment gets stronger and faster, you need to go longer in order to counteract it. And we're going to get to a point where, you know, remembering your 24-digit password, no matter how easy it was to remember, is just going to be impossible to type accurately. So they're replacing traditional password with something that's more secure and easier than a two-factor authentication that I use for stuff through Google Authenticator. So when I log into a website, I get a screen that pops up, and I need to provide a 6-digit code that comes off the authenticator app that I have on my smartphone. So in order for me to log in somewhere, or for somebody to use my credentials, they'd have to have my user ID, my password, and my smartphone.
Yeah, so it's a combination of everything that makes it so much more difficult.
Yeah, so what Yahoo is doing is something called Yahoo Account Key, where they're going to push a notice to a cell phone or smartwatch to verify user identity. So when you log in, instead of supplying your password, Yahoo is just going to basically go, okay, it's you, and send a message to your phone, and you authenticate that way. So it's instead of password and phone, then you just basically are going to, you know, something you carry. And this is similar to other types of token type access, like having an RSA, you know, key.
Well, how often do you think we have to do that in order to get into your email? It won't be cumbersome where it's every single time you have to get in.
Well, it will, actually.
It will be. So,
and that's, you know, I mean, I started using Google Authenticator partly because it just made sense and partly because I wanted to see how it worked and frankly, how big of a pain in the butt it is because, you know, if I'm recommending this to people and it's really cumbersome, well, you know, it's kind of a pain. And I will say, when my phone's on the charger and I'm trying to log in somewhere and got to climb a flight of stairs to go retrieve my phone, kind of a pain in the butt. But I'm still doing it because I really appreciate that
because
you've security.
Because you're paranoid and you've already established that.
You know. So, you know, the rule on two-factor authentication is don't lose your phone.
Well, yeah. Well, how about I've been reading about biological ways to identify yourself biologically. That could be something that really would be great.
Yeah, they're working on things beyond biometrics. We've already seen like fingerprint scanners on stuff like that.
But like your DNA.
And they've talked about using webcam to do an iris scan. You know, look at the pattern, not a retinal scan, but an iris scan, the patterns on the front of your eyeball. One of the most interesting ones has to do with the way you type in your password. This comes way, you know, back from.
Oh, interesting. The pauses and stuff.
Yeah. You know, in the days of, you know, the telegraph, when things were typed out using Morse code, telegraph operators could recognize who was at the other end of the wire by the way they tapped. And we all have sort of a unique way that we do this kind of stuff that identifies us well enough for the machine.
Well, it's like when people are walking up the stairs, you always knew if it was your brother or your sister walking up and down the stairs by how they walk up and down.
Just how they do it. And so, you know, we're looking at things like that as well. And they're talking about, you know, like facial recognition, you know, again, using a webcam that's embedded in the device. And I think that, you know, authentication is going to depend on, you know, at least two-factor and possibly three-factor authentication in some really secure locations. I'm also using a password manager program called LastPass, which allows me to use very long passwords that I don't have to remember. In fact, I can use LastPass to generate random, you know, gibberish passwords of any length that I choose. And the software remembers the password. I just need to remember the major password, you know, to get into LastPass. And then just I have LastPass set up with Google Authenticator, I have to provide that, you know, two-factor. And so this is really a pretty secure way for me to have long passwords that are completely unique on every site without having to remember anything. And it works actually really well. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, I want to move into another topic because I know we always like talking about Snowden.
Right.
Let's get into him.
Yeah.
Do you think that he'll ever be allowed back into the country? Or do you think he'll ever get a fair trial?
I don't think he can get a fair trial in the United States.
Unless our politics really change.
And, you know, here's the problem. Is we have, you know, I mean, Republicans historically have not been very forgiving, you know, when it comes to spy craft, if we want to call it. You know, was he a whistleblower? Was he a spy? You know, I look at him as a whistleblower, you know, letting us know for sure the things that we'd already expect, you know, suspected for decades.
Oh, are they saying he's a Russian spy or something?
No, but, you know, he's being, under U.S. law, his activities are being treated as espionage. And in the United States, espionage is a capital offense for which you could be, you know, executed. Okay. You know, his claim is that he just basically was working as a whistleblower, essentially. And,
well, and I had someone from the Freedom of the Press. She's responsible for the United States section. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about, you know, from Reporters Without Borders, and she thinks full-heartedly they think that Snowden is a whistleblower and that he hasn't released anything that's sensitive and that he's been really responsible about what he says so that people don't get hurt. But he thinks it's important that people understand what is really going on. Yeah, it's just transparency, what your government is doing.
Yeah, this isn't Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks. He is being much more – he's basically saying people have a right to know that they're being spied on by their own government. And I, you know, seriously, not shocked. Okay, when all this stuff came out, it's like, okay, this just proves what I already suspected. But, you know, I wasn't the only one. We all, you know, it's like the NSA has a huge facility in Maryland and a new one going in Utah and, you know, computing capacity that is ridiculous. And they're not just spying on terrorists with this crap. They're spying on everybody. Well, and it's not that they're spying on everybody. It's that they're absorbing nearly, you know, as much of the signal content of the world as they possibly can. So everything on telephone, everything on internet, everything that's being transferred electronically, cell phones, satellite communications, you know, they're hoovering it all up and turning very big, powerful machines loose, listening for keywords and certain activities and certain phrases and certain sources and certain, you know.
And I can understand why they'd be doing it. The scary part for me is when and if the bad guys actually are in your government. Mm-hmm. You know, we are going to get infiltrated, and that's the scary part. And that's why Thomas Jefferson, his quote about anybody, something about liberty, if you want.
Yep. Security and liberty, yeah.
Do you remember that quote?
Willing to, trade security for liberty, soon you'll have neither.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and that's kind of where we're going. But
well, my whole thing, and this, you know, comes under the, you know, black helicopter guy kind of a thing is that, but, you know, the United States government wanted Al Capone for murder, and they settled on tax evasion because that's what they could prove.
Yeah.
and the whole issue is not whether there's anything going on in your life that's worth it or not. But let's say you get your, you know, rump in an uproar and you decide to run for public office because you're like mad as heck and don't want to take it anymore. And if somebody in the government is determined to see that not happen, they will scour through your life and find out your dirty little secrets and release them to the media and pretty much, you know, ruin your, or if it's worse than that, they'll find something they can charge you with and they'll put you in prison. And, you know, I'm sorry that none of our hands are so clean that there isn't something.
Yeah. Well, exactly. If they can nail any of us, and that's the scary part.
Yeah, the whole part of liberty and privacy is that unless they find you doing something wrong, you're pretty much free to get away with anything, including wrong.
Well, but it's supposed to, if you're just living your life normally and you're not a bad guy, then you shouldn't be harassed like that. But I'm a
normal guy that speeds, you know, more than a little bit. And, you know, I'm a, you know, what the heck, you know, there's dozens of things that if they, I don't know.
Well, if they want, you don't want to tell everybody. But if they put it, it's not even, people do break laws without even knowing they're breaking laws because there's so many laws. And so you can put any story together about anybody and make them, but if you live your life in a moral, ethical way, you should be able to be free.
You should be. Yep.
But they can, anybody, they can go after the pastor down the street that really tries.
Yeah.
That's what's so sad. But does the Patriot Act give the U.S. the right to watch our every move?
No.
Where does it limit it?
Maybe it's written in the Patriot Act that's permitted. But actually, the stuff that the NSA and the Homeland Security and that the kind of activity they're engaged in has not been authorized legally anywhere. That's just that they're doing it. They're doing it because it's possible. And, you know, I kind of fall back on the same argument I use, you know, with people who are desperately trying to exercise copyrights on, you know, creative works that they hold that have been pirated electronically. You can't stop a thing that's possible. And you really can't stop it if it's possible and easy. If it's, you know, easy to do, well, it's going to be done, regardless of whatever the laws say. And
that's why you got to protect your. That's why businesses need to protect themselves.
Yeah,
and everybody.
And, you know, the governments are speaking out against encryption, and here with the Paris thing, they're already, you know, flapping their lips about, you know, encryption is allowing the bad guys to plan stuff without us being able to figure it out, and. You know, they'll never be able to outlaw encryption because, again, it's possible and easy. And in an electronic world, people will encrypt. And if you make encryption illegal, then only criminals will use it. You know, I mean, it's the gun argument.
Exactly.
You know, and
only
so,
criminals will be able to get by with it.
Yeah,
and everybody else
you know,
will.
Because
they're not going to. Criminals don't look at laws and go, oh, they said it's illegal, so let's not do that when we're about ready to steal $5 billion and kill 200 people.
We got six guys from ISIS walking into the Mall of America, and they see that sign that says the Mall of America bans gun on the premises. I'm sure they leave all their stuff in the trunk.
I mean, they need that.
It's, you know, the laws do not have.
Laws only keep the good people from doing it.
Well, laws only give you legal remedies when they're broken. They don't prevent them from, you know, these things from happening. They just give you, you know,
recourse. Yeah, if they cared about the law, they wouldn't be out there trying to kill 100 people. It's just crazy. Okay, well, let's move on to one other topic I wanted to talk to you before we. 60 Minutes recently had an article or a story on the ongoing warfare with China in space, and it has to do with satellite systems and stuff.
Satellite stuff,
The Space Command. How much do you think cyber warfare is going on in our satellite systems?
Well, it's probably a lot more than we might imagine. You know, that I hadn't seen that 60 Minutes episode, so I went online and you know, watched the two episodes of where they covered it, and you know what they're really talking about is, you know, sending satellites up to destroy other satellites, you know, and in terms of like physical warfare, satellite to satellite. And I can only hope that that's like a really bad idea nobody's going to do, because the problem with objects at high orbit, and we're already running into this with
the debris,
I dropped wrench, or there's a bolt flying around loose out there, or whatever. This stuff's all whizzing around at, you know, 250,000 miles an hour. And, you know, when it hits another device that's up there in orbit, the results can be catastrophic.
Can't we just take this huge, like, net and go in there and catch all the debris?
Yeah. a big magnet. Just kind of tow it around behind the space shuttle. Yeah. But,
the garbage collector.
Yeah. But, you know, so if we start, like, blowing up each other's stuff, well, pretty soon there won't be a place to have to orbit. You know, there's only a few distances into the, you know, outer space where it makes sense to orbit stuff.
But yeah, what that's telling me is
synchronous, and then there's the, you know, the north-south where they're looping around more quickly. But
well, what that's telling me is China's going after things from a cyber warfare standpoint, and we're still going after it physically.
Well, I think what
that's what they were saying.
Yeah, but you know, China has a well-deserved reputation as being happy to take any electronic stuff they can get their hands on.
And they're more business-oriented, right? And, they're more stealing the business. Yeah.
Although I think the Chinese are totally, you know, they're omnivorous. You know, we're pretty sure that, for instance, the Office of Personnel Management hack, that was Chinese. And so there was some really sensitive information about people with security clearances here in the United States that is now in the hands of Chinese. God knows what they want to do with it. But I don't know that they care. They just, you know, it's kind of like, what did you get there? Well, I got, you know, they're sort of like scavengers almost. In that, you know, they go down the alley looking in garbage cans, taking what they can find, and then sorting it out later. And, you know, sometimes I wonder just how disingenuous our complaints are about the Chinese, because I got to imagine we're spying on them.
Oh, well, yeah, of course. But, you know, the Chinese is getting pretty smart. What is the mineral that that is mined that's pretty rare that's in all of our electronics? Oh, it escapes me.
Yeah.
But they've pretty much cornered that market.
Yep,
and
yep.
They are we don't even produce much of it anymore, and it's in everything.
Yeah, and a lot of it's in Africa. A lot of those rare earth elements that come out of Africa, and the Chinese are doing a really good job of working with African governments and African businesses to exploit those minerals. And so they, of course, have first dibs on, you know, the importation of.
Well, that's where it gets scary, because when they corner an entire market and they have control over the supply, I mean, we have to be smart on some of these things. We need to make sure we have supply of things that are so fundamental to our development, you know?
But, you know, here again, I don't know how much electronics manufacture actually happens here in the United States anymore. So
that's
it's not
true.
Not like we're importing it anyway.
And, that's true.
And the other thing that you know, and this is another argument, is, you know, all of our cool toys are being made overseas in the event of a global war. We don't even have that capacity to build that stuff here. You know, what's that going to be like?
True. And that's, you know, what made us so powerful during World War II, is that we became this big industrialized component.
They're not building Android smartphones in, you know, Nevada. They're building them elsewhere. Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm just, you know, there's some of that. But I know that the U.S. has some strategic reserves of everything, not just oil, but all these, you know, rare earth elements and what have you. So theoretically, we've protected ourselves from that stuff. But yeah, you know, Chinese corner of the market in some of these special, you know, special electronic. Was it beryllium?
Yeah, I think it's beryllium.
It's a lot of
them. Yeah,
funny little things, and you just have to. Well, to a certain extent, it means we really have to stay friends with the Chinese.
It does.
Hey,
it does.
Thanks for buying all that debt. And, oh, by the way, we'd like to borrow a couple beryllium, you know.
It means we better be careful.
Yeah, we'll try to keep up on the interest payments, because we really don't want to tick you off.
We won't go bankrupt. We'll keep working at this.
Yeah.
So do you think that – this is kind of off the topic, but do you think that Space Command has essentially replaced NASA? Because NASA doesn't have much of a budget. So do you think it's going on in Space Command?
You know, what I'm seeing with NASA is a trend that, frankly, I've been advocating for ages, and that is that space exploration is becoming privatized. You have SpaceX and a number of other companies that are busy. You know, and you have, who the heck was it? There was a case settled recently that if you're mining an asteroid and you find stuff, it belongs to you. That's a legal precedent that has been established now in the courts. And we're not mining asteroids. Nobody's got that capability, but we've already laid the legal groundwork for basically going out to the asteroid belt, landing, and sticking your little, you know, flag in the soil and saying, I claim this for me, and then digging it out and shipping all the rare earth elements.
That's so interesting, because we wouldn't go through that trouble unless we thought it was pretty close to being able to be real.
So. Yeah. It's kind of like, huh. But in any event, so we have the, you know, public companies, you know, regular companies that are taking over the exploration and exploitation part of it. And then we have the military that's dealing with the defensive, you know, the Space Command and the Cyber Command and all these different new little groups that are busy, you know, those guys in Arizona who fly drones all over the world and blow things up. You know, there's all kinds of new groups of people out there.
It's just NASA's an outdated structure almost.
Well, now, you know, the budget for NASA was never really that big a percentage of the entire U.S. budget, even in its heydays in the 60s and 70s, or the 70s, I guess, because of 69 that, well, I don't know, it was 62 or 3 that John Kennedy lit the fuse on that deal. So the 60s and 70s. Pretty much they're involved in, you know, like the International Space Station, which really, you know, what they're trying to do is build a platform for going out, you know, permanent base on the moon, and then whatever the heck we can do with Mars. But,
which is kind of cool. You have to admit.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are you working on nowadays? What's going on in your life?
Well, got the big change with, you know, I went to work for Computer Integration Technologies in Woodbury.
That's Woodbury, Minnesota, right?
Yeah, Woodbury, Minnesota. Yep. I had been a independent entrepreneur for over a decade, and, you know, I had my own computer support business, and then was really trying to morph it into a computer, you know, a cybersecurity business. Been working at that for about 4 years. And when the opportunity came along to work for CIT and to basically start a cybersecurity practice in their existing computer business, it was kind of a cool opportunity. They do almost everything for their clients. Custom software writing.
And it's such a big thing now for companies, right? The whole security and cybersecurity. So,
yeah, yeah.
And that's really what you want to do. You want to build, you're building yep. a division at this company and leading up their whole cyber
right.
security
and,
division.
Know, working on different stuff and trying to develop some, you know, I guess what we call products for them, service bundles.
So.
Put together pricing and what have you, but I'm out there, you know, working with clients too, you know, hands on the machine and you know, using my hackery good stuff. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, I'll include all that in the website, your contact information. I know I'm sure that people are interested in hearing. You'll be on again. I like having you on. It's always fun to talk to you about these things, but if in the case that people want to get hold of you, they can, I'll have all that information up and they have business issues, password issues, whatever kind of security issues that can get hold of you.
Right. Yep.
But I want to thank you so much. And if I don't talk to you before the holidays, have a wonderful holiday season.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And you too.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
I'll be posting the full interview on my website as a podcast, and that should be up later today. And if you want to find information on Bob Weiss and how to get hold of him, that will be posted on my website as well. Please go there, sarahwestall.com. Tell me your comments, suggestions. I want to hear from you on what you think of the show and what else you think we should be covering. So for now, I hope everyone has a wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific Time. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.